Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. I'm Fraser Nelson. Each week during lockdown, we've been asking three of our writers to read out what they've written for the magazine. This week, we have James Forsyth reading his cover story on Boris Johnson's Mission Impossible to rewire Whitehall. We've got Douglas Murray writing a column about a leaked memo he's had from an NHS chief suggesting what the underlings might like to read to educate themselves on culture wars. And finally, Leith Arbuthnot, who went underground to the various speakeasies and secret theatres happening in London right now. First, James Forsyth.
Rewiring the state. COVID has revealed what is wrong with Whitehall. It is never a good sign when a government relaunches itself. Look what happened at the end of Theresa May's time in power. There was a relaunch almost every other week, each one with diminishing effect. But although it has been overhyped, Boris Johnson's attempt to start again isn't a mere rebranding exercise. It is not just about rehashing policy proposals, but about trying to tackle the dysfunction at the heart of the state. The PM is attempting to do something past leaders have thought to be an impossible job, to rewire the whole system. Johnson has time on his side, 4 years to get things back on track, and a Commons majority. But there's a paradox at the heart of his big reform project. If he's so frank, almost brutal about the failings of government, how can he be pinning his hopes on government to solve this country's economic problems? In normal circumstances, a politician's view of the efficiency of government informs their view on the role of the state. The post-war Labour government was animated by the belief that the man in Whitehall knows best, and so the state became ever more involved in both the economy and in people's everyday lives. Margaret Thatcher thought individuals were better judged of their own needs than government, and set about rolling back the frontiers of a state. This number 10 thinks that the British administrative state is deeply flawed, dysfunctional even, but it is nevertheless relying on government, albeit of a reform kind, to deliver the changes it believes are crucial to this country's future prosperity. If Michael Gove thinks the civil service is so out of sympathy with the majority of the country, then why isn't he proposing to cut this flawed leviathan down to size? The Thatcher-Reagan approach would seem to be a more logical reaction to the failings of government. But it's worth remembering that when Reagan declared in his first inaugural that government was the problem, not the solution, he caveated it with the phrase, in this crisis. Reagan was still an admirer of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. It was a reminder that circumstances matter in politics, and in the current situation, government has to be a significant part of the solution. The problem Britain faces today are a far cry from those of the 1980s. One ally of the Prime Minister sums up the mood as, the machine is dead, let us build a new machine and advance. Even before COVID, this country was in a productivity crisis, and it is now impossible to improve productivity without government involvement. Increasing productivity requires improvements to be made to physical and digital infrastructure, and to the skills base, and those need public investment. One of the reasons Johnson is so keen on big infrastructure projects is that he thinks this is one area where the public sector doesn't crowd out the private sector. But he has to stop allowing such projects to waste so much time and money. Can he succeed? His is not the first government to attempt to reform Whitehall. For two generations, British politicians have been trying to make the administrative state function better, and with little success. Some ministers regard it as a distraction from the issues that the government should be focusing on. One observes that it is always easier to blame things on structures than to solve problems with policy. Veterans of a Cameron government are beginning to chuckle with schadenfreude. They regarded Whitehall reform as the ultimate rabbit hole for any Prime Minister to go down. And yet it remains true that nothing significant can change until the machinery of government functions properly. And if the COVID crisis has made one thing clear, it is that it currently does not. Johnson and his circle believe that reforming Whitehall is existential to this government's prospects. One Tory tells me sorting out the state isn't an esoteric thing, but key to delivering on the things that will keep our seats. Their fear is that without a state that can deliver, they'll be swept out of office in 2024 by the appeal of time for a change after 14 years of Tory rule. So what will a rewired government look like? At the heart of the project are changes to the Cabinet Office. The departure of Smart Sedwell as Cabinet Secretary and National Security Advisor is just a start. There will be limits to this revolution. Sedwell's replacement will be a current or former permanent secretary. The first Civil Service Commissioner Ian Watmore insisted on that. But this bar of bringing in an outsider matters less because the role of a cabinet secretary is about to change significantly. In the new disposition, the cabinet secretary's most important role will be as head of a civil service. Number 10 have no chosen candidate, so this will be a genuine competition. But some permanent secretaries are not in serious contention. Number 10 thinks the institutional response of the Department of Health and Social Care to this crisis has been deeply flawed. So that perhaps rules out Chris Wormald at the Department of Health. Antonio Romeo, the Permanent Secretary of the Department for International Trade, is another much-tipped name who is unlikely to get the job. There's no requirement for the next Cabinet Secretary to be a Brexiteer, but interestingly, the view in Whitehall is that of the 40 or so Permanent Secretaries, only one voted for Leave, and perhaps two more are Brexit curious. The new number 10 Permanent Secretary, Simon Case, who is highly regarded, will take on an expanded role in this new system. I understand that the Domestic Policy Secretariat, which resolves disputes between government departments, will report to him. This team will have embedded in it something akin to Tony Blair's delivery unit. Its role will be to chase policy across Whitehall, ensuring that there is follow-through on the government's commitments. At the same time, the National Security Secretariat will report to David Frost, the Prime Minister's chief Brexit negotiator, who is the new National Security Advisor. This setup will be in place by the autumn. Cynics say that reforming Whitehall has been attempted before, and that it always fails. There is a reason to think that this time might be different, though. COVID. The virus has been a test of governments and systems of governments around the world. No one can look at the UK death toll and conclude that this must be one of the best governed countries in the world. It is clear that in terms of public administration, we lag behind Germany and far behind the Asian democracies. This realisation means that the forces of reform in Whitehall have been strengthened and the forces of conservatism weakened. As one Secretary of State puts it, crises provide an opportunity to upend some of the things that haven't worked in the past. And the secret spur pushing on the reform agenda is the inevitable public inquiry into the government's handling of COVID. There'll be plenty of criticisms to make, but the machinery of government is bound to come in for heavy fire, strengthening the case for change. Ministers now accept that the state really does need reforming, that it has failed its stress test. One of those intimately involved in the government's coronavirus response tells me, people have been astonished at how rotten much of the British state is. Every time you look up close to check that part of it is functioning okay, you find disaster. It's like leaning on what seems to be a solid wall and finding it's rotten. Your hand pushes straight through. Johnson's been radicalised by the experience. I'm told that he's much more interested in reforming the civil service than he was pre-March. Perhaps more important than the effect the crisis has had on ministers is that it has strengthened the view of a cadre of Whitehall highflyers that change is needed. But the civil service can't just go on congratulating itself on being a Rolls-Royce machine. This is why the 41-year-old Case is such an important figure in this Whitehall revamp. One admirer of his says he represents a younger generation who understand that things have gone awry. This younger generation is important because no changes at Whitehall are going to work unless there are civil servants who agree that they are necessary. Reform is not something that can be simply imposed by ministerial diktat. Even more important than the shift in structures is the shift in mindset intended to accompany it. A more rigorous examination is required of whether government policies have delivered returns on money put into them. The government aims to make data publicly available in order to enable faster course correction, but it is far from achieving this. Take Leicester. The coronavirus testing data that is the basis of locking down the city is not open to external examination. The new emphasis on data must properly distinguish between data and modelling. Data has real analytical value. It enables robust discussion of what has worked and what has not. Modelling is a far less exact science. In this crisis, as in the 2008 financial crisis, models have been more of a hindrance than a help. Curing this country's ills requires an effective government, but it will also take a realistic idea of what government can do. The failure of a test and trace app is a reminder that government technology projects can sound great, but be deeply flawed in practice. The emphasis should be on allowing government to get on with doing the things it is best suited to, building infrastructure, taking care of public health, and ensuring access to education and skills training. There's a danger that this desire to use the state will lapse back into tired thinking. There is something depressing about the emphasis Johnson is putting on building new schools in the North and the Midlands. If the government thinks that one of the biggest problems of education in England is the quality of the school estate, then it really is out of ideas. Levelling up has to mean more than just building new schools and hospitals in deprived places. Relying on the effectiveness of government is an uncomfortable place for any centre-right administration to be. But this is where Boris Johnson's Conservatives find themselves. His future is dependent on his ability to make government work better.
That was James Forsyth. Now Douglas Murray.
Of all the people who have made cash in the past month, few can have raked it in like Robin DiAngelo. Since the death of George Floyd, the white American academic and author of White Fragility has been absolutely milking it. A term I probably shouldn't use, since PETA last week declared milk a symbol of white supremacy. I might say she is absolutely creaming it, though by the time you read this, cream might be racist too. In which case, it will join the British countryside, which was designated as racist by the BBC's Country File last week. A fact that I learned after opening Google's homepage, where I was educated about the late black American drag queen, Marsha Johnson. Anyhow, I mention D'Angelo because even before her recent rush of fame, anyone wishing to employ her to correct their opinions had to shell out $6,000 an hour, or $12,000 for 2 hours. That is what D'Angelo charged the University of Kentucky last year for a 2-hour session on racial injustice. I imagine that she charges more for all those CEOs now queuing up to hire the Miss Whiplash of anti-racism to come up to their offices and spend an afternoon telling them how bad and worthless they are. Then there are the book sales. Ever since a Minnesota cop killed Mr. Floyd, endless companies and individuals have sent out reading lists, instructing us all of what to read. Each time, D'Angelo's 2018 work tops the list. Consider a document I've just been leaked from the office of the chief executive of the Birmingham and Solihull NHS Mental Health Trust. Dated 5th of June and titled Inequalities and Racial Discrimination, it starts by claiming that recent events in America have highlighted once again the discrimination and inequality experienced by people of BAME heritage every day. The 3-page letter goes on, "It is not up to our BAME colleagues to make this right. They are, quite honestly and understandably, fed up of repeatedly telling their stories and not being understood." The author of this letter is one Roisin Fallon Williams, who in these anti-racist times, I ought to point out, is white. She knows what to do. "I write this to us all, from what I now know and understand to be an ignorant and incompetent stance," she says. "Whilst I remain ignorant and incompetent, I do now better understand that I am culpable. I have been complicit." She goes on to urge her equally incompetent and ignorant colleagues to take time to go up to BAME colleagues and say, "How are you?" and "Are you okay?" and to really listen to what they say. All of which raises the question, as such anti-racists always do, of what precisely they got up to until the day before yesterday. On the 3rd page of Self-Flagellation, Miss Fallon Williams suggests 4 works that her ignorant and incompetent colleagues should read. It is the usual list, though Fallon Williams may be unaware that half of her suggested texts are by white authors. One is a work by Peggy McIntosh of Wellesley College. "Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack" has been so often cited over the 3 decades since it was written that, until reading it a while back, I had assumed that there was something there. I was wrong. The entire work simply consists of a few pages of assertions intended to demonstrate the daily effects of white privilege. The first is, "I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time." Assertion number 33 is, "I am not made acutely aware that my shape, bearing, or body odour will be taken as a reflection on my race." An assertion that only tempts me to make a whole set of reflections on the shape, bearing, and body odour of white female academics from Wellesley. But top of Fallon Williams's reading list is that work which, while longer than McIntosh's, is in many ways still flimsier. The central assertion of white fragility is that all white people are racist. White people who are aggrieved at being told that they are racist are said by D'Angelo to be demonstrating white fragility, which is further demonstration of their racism. All of which leaves white people, in their entirety, in that conundrum faced by witches facing a dunking in the village pond. It is a game of D'Angelo's creation, which, once engaged in, cannot be won. Except by her. Obvs. Of course, some good people are getting carried along by all of this. People of every skin colour who believe our society is intrinsically racist and that, as a result, everything must be understood through the lens of skin colour. Others of us, also of every skin colour, beg to differ. Not because we are racists or think our societies can't be better, but because we think that what is being demanded of us by the anti-racism professors and others is a racialist hell of a fresh kind. Like the Black Lives Matter movement itself, the social justice typified by the works of McIntosh and D'Angelo is set up to be all but unopposable. Like those peace studies departments that mysteriously cropped up during the Cold War, the apparently impossible to oppose front has deep, destructive and, yes, Marxist aims all the way behind it. Today, this is presented as though it is eminently simple to download. We must simply absorb the right books, correct our language, follow the instructions, and otherwise run the programme. Well, you can do, or you can refuse, and I would strongly recommend the latter approach. For what the race hucksters are offering is not an upgrade of our societal software. Rather, theirs is a programme intended to distort and destroy the whole system. A system that may have its faults, but does not deserve the introduction of such societal malware. From the boardroom to the NHS and everywhere else in society, I suggest people make sure they understand the consequences of what they are agreeing to. Be very, very careful before clicking accept all.
That was Douglas Murray, now Leif Arbuthnot.
Among the first to arrive was a Labour grandee. Then others drifted over, academics, musicians, writers, a nurse. They came from different directions, some looking shifty, others excited. The secret meeting point was an inconspicuous pub in North London. Queuing shoppers nearby assumed the growing crowd was waiting to get into the supermarket. In groups of five, those gathered were led down a suburban street to a derelict leisure centre. For one night only, the gym had been turned into a makeshift theatre. The audience, of up to 30 people, had congregated to flick a collective V at the social distancing measures and to watch A Hero of Our Time, a three-hander adapted by Hunch Theatre from the 1840 novel by Mikhail Lermontov. Inside the theatre, it was as if the past 4 months had been a very weird dream. Audience members kissed one another on the cheek without compunction, shared wine, and finally settled shoulder to shoulder on the floor to watch. There was not a face mask in sight. Since the lockdown began on the 23rd of March, Britain's cultural life has moved online. Gigs are streamed and books launched on Zoom. Art made in captivity is relayed in anemic photos on social media. For some, the transition to digital has been intuitive, beneficial even. The number of people who participated in this year's digital-only Hay Festival was almost double the number who normally buy tickets. But broadly, it's been a dire time for people in the arts. Many are freelance and are neither on furlough nor qualify for government support. Incomes have vanished overnight. A recent study by the forecaster Oxford Economics found that coronavirus will wallop Britain's creative industries twice as hard as it will impact the economy overall. More than 400,000 jobs are expected to go, and revenues are forecast to drop by £74 billion. Behind these cosmic figures are real people who are out of work or soon will be, and who are confronting an uncertain future. While the country is gearing up to open on the 4th of July, many galleries, clubs and concert venues will not. Cameron McIntosh has said that he doesn't expect West End theatres to reopen until 2021. With a situation as bleak as this, it is little wonder that some in the arts are beginning to rebel. One of the organisers of last week's clandestine play, who would rather not be named, has been taken aback by the overconformist attitude that has swept the arts world since the start of the pandemic. People have signed over their health to the state as if they can't make up their own minds about what risk to take. Staying indoors isn't living. Life under lockdown has been reduced to a Zoom meeting. It's unhealthy and atomising. I find it hilarious that the left wants to be on the side of Tory laws and regulations. When asked if she worries about audience members infecting one another and going back into the community, she points out that everything is risk, life is risk. The most important thing shouldn't be safety. Rule breaking isn't just happening in rarefied theatre circles. Invitations to raves and club nights are going, well, viral. George Hull, a veteran rave promoter, believes there will be more illegal parties this summer than there have been in decades. It's already happening up and down the country. Gen Z kids are quite a spirited lot, and they've been stripped of the option of going to an overpriced club night or festival. So it stands to reason that they'll go to unlicensed raves. Listen out for the new sounds that will inevitably bubble up from these sweaty incubators of creativity, just as Acid House did in the 1980s. One quarantine party organiser reveals he's bought antibody tests from Ireland for people to take as they enter the warehouse, where he'll host an invite-only night dedicated to general debauchery and the music of Sidney Bechet. He's also considered getting a dog as a bouncer, as they're rumoured to be decent coronavirus detectors. The science suggests this is bollocks. The night before the play in North London, a dropped pin on WhatsApp maps the way to a new speakeasy. You pitch up at a central London townhouse, ring the doorbell, pay £20, and are led to a series of darkened rooms. The crowd is young, posh, cokey, and cosmopolitan. As the night jitters on, the bar begins to feel more like a nightclub. Deprived of touch for months on end, people brush one another's arms and stand a little too close, or gather by the speakers to be blasted by music. It sweeps the COVID cobwebs away. For obvious reasons, it's hard to be sure quite how much is going on behind closed doors. Polls have shown the lockdown to be surprisingly popular. Many in the arts are young, left-wing Remain voters who approve of the measures or believe they're not tough enough. Recent research by LSE found that leavers and those on the right, a group not overrepresented in the arts, tend to be more sceptical of the lockdown. An actor friend confirms that everyone she knows in the industry is playing nice, not as a mark of respect for the Conservatives, but out of duty to the NHS. Yet, the longer actors and others in the arts are deprived of their livelihoods, the more clandestine activity will spread. It's not just that people need to earn their crust, or even that they understandably don't want to retrain in lockdown-friendly trades. It's that many feel creatively famished. Of course, this isn't the first time that the arts have suffered as a result of edicts from on high. Theatres were closed by Parliament in 1642, having been deemed hothouses of lascivious mirth and levity. Sounds great. The ban was lifted after those in the industry insisted they cleaned up their act. "We have purged our stages of all obscene and scurrilous jests," insisted the writer of the 1643 Actors' Remonstrance. Behind the Iron Curtain, Soviet hippies stole coils from phones to string their electric guitars and play band music. When war broke out in 1939, London theatres closed, but soon reopened under public pressure. The arts adapted to the rationing of costumes, makeup, and paper, and some London troupes performed in the safer provinces. The Old Vic, for instance, took a production of Macbeth through Welsh mining villages. In London, theatre-goers prided themselves on their resilience. When Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit opened in 1941 at the Piccadilly, the audience gamely climbed over rubble to reach the theatre. Audiences today are more fearful. Just 15% of regulars are booking tickets, according to research by Indigo, and there has been no noticeable clamour from the public to jumpstart Britain's cultural life. Yet how long will this attitude last? If live streams, maybe supplemented by the odd no-contact play, continue to be all that's on offer into October, might we not finally hear cries of COVID be damned? At the peak of the lockdown in April, the inveterate rule-breaker and performance artist Anne Bean left her home at dawn to put up an installation on the foreshore of the Thames. At the time, the messaging from the government was almost monosyllabic: stay home, etc. Bean says she had the strange feeling as she put up the art that what she was doing was much more transgressive than past installations, many of which had led to run-ins with police. In other parts of the country, communities of artists are coming together to organise gatherings and performances, despite the lockdown. But there's a lot of jumpiness about. One gallery owner was going to host an opening, but got cold feet when word got round that she might be planning some sort of rebellion. Raphael Todes, a musician, was ticked off by the police when he and his family formed a string quartet on their street. The copper listened to us play for 15 minutes, then at the end he accused us of incitement to gather. It was a great plod phrase, Todds explains. Unlikely as it is that audiences will pack out big-name venues soon, how many more musicians and actors will be forced to break the law in order to find employment? A cultural community that in many ways seems to have forgotten how to defy the state might, however, need some lessons. There are few directors better placed to remind us of the art of disobedience than the man behind the unauthorised North London performance, Vladimir Sherbin, who was once a key member of a celebrated underground Eastern European theatre company whose productions were regularly shut down by the police. As William Cook wrote last month, the old way of doing things wasn't working for everyone anyway. Moving performances into disused spaces, car parks, leisure centres, warehouses, and making shows more immersive and mobile could attract new audiences and free up the art form. The Lermontov play had two acts. After the interval, the audience was led to an empty swimming pool, which had become the Russian spa town of Kislovodsk. Everyone climbed down rickety iron ladders and watched the drama come to an end. The story finished, like all Russian dramas worth their salt, with a duel. High above the pool, a skylight measured the dimming of the day. The play was a tour de force, not only because of the faultless performances and ingenious direction, but because of the extraordinary setting and the ferocity of the world that the play had kept at bay. The spell lingered for hours afterwards, made even more potent by the copious shots of homemade vodka distributed free to audience and actors alike, who caroused into the night. Was the organiser frightened of being caught? She shrugs. I'm not personally worried about getting busted. It's obviously risky, but I would be prepared to go to prison for putting on a play.
That was Leif Arbuthnot. Thank you for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. And do let us know what you think of this and our other podcasts. You can email us on podcast@spectator.co.uk. It's always great to hear from you, good or bad, and get ideas as to how we can improve our podcasts in the future. Thanks for listening again, and thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.